Today is March 21st, 2018. The first day of spring. It's cold. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the programs available on wbai.org/archive. It's also available on prn.fm and on our website, pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio and PRN.FM on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program except when WBAI is in a membership drive, the programs are different. It's been a long time and hopefully all the work will get done. What am I talking about? Verizon had promised Fios for New York City by 2014. We're now in 2018, and much of the work is yet to be done. Verizon now has reached a proposed settlement for completion of the work in New York, and in this case, New York means New York City and New York State. The PSC began reviewing Verizon's service quality in March of 2014, 7 months after New York State Attorney General Eric Schneiderman asked for an investigation into whether Verizon is adequately upgrading or repairing its copper wire infrastructure. Verizon reached a proposed settlement subject to approval by the State Public Service Commission. And here's a list of things that Verizon said that they will do. We're going to keep track of them. Verizon will fix New York copper lines and potentially upgrade more than 30,000 homes. Verizon has agreed to fix failing copper networks and boost fiber deployment in New York. 2 years after state officials began investigating the quality of Verizon landline phones and broadband service, a settlement with Verizon will require the company to repair 54 central offices across the state, replace bad cable, defective equipment, faulty backup batteries, and take down 64,000 double telephone poles. The agreement also includes increased broadband build-out to major apartment buildings in New York City and more than 30,000 homes across the state. I know that many people in New York are still saying, is there really Fios in New York? The settlement calls for fiber deployment at an additional 24,000 to 32,000 business and residents across the state, although most of these are dependent on Verizon receiving state broadband grants that it already applied for. The deployment number agreed to in the settlement is in addition to those that would otherwise be required under the grant program. There will also be fiber upgrades for some New York City customers whose copper lines have repeatedly failed. Verizon will identify 100 copper-fed building locations in New York City with a high incidence of repair visits by technicians and will replace the existing copper facilities to those locations with fiber optics. Verizon was required to bring fiber to every customer in New York City by June 2014 under an agreement signed in 2008, but many residents still lack fiber service. The city filed a lawsuit against Verizon, and Telco claims it met the requirements to pass all household and blames building owners for not allowing access to certain properties. That's not true at all, and I know it because there are many two-family homes which they are the owners, and they're still waiting for access. They're still waiting for Fios access. Under the new settlement, Verizon would have 2 years to complete the 100-building requirement, subject to delays caused by access issues. The new settlement gives Verizon 4 years. That's too much time to give them, really. But I'll repeat, the new settlement gives Verizon 4 years to remove 64,000 double poles, which can cause dangerous conditions. Double poles occurs when Verizon has failed to move its equipment from old poles that was replaced with a new one by another utility. And Verizon would have 2 years to fix copper problems at central offices that haven't met performance standards. I don't know why we're taking such a long time, 2 years and 4 years. Hey, we should also say, if you don't do it, we're going to bring in another service. New York says Charter, which offers Spectrum, lied about new broadband and threatens to revoke its franchise. Charter tried to count old broadband towards new merger commitments. New York government officials have threatened to terminate Charter Communications franchise agreements with New York City, saying the cable company failed to meet broadband construction requirements and may not have paid all its required franchise fees. The New York Public Service Commission said Charter should pay $1 million fine for missing a deadline to expand its broadband network statewide and is questioning Charter over declines in franchise fees paid to New York City. Charter may have some real declines in subscribers because of cord cutting. New York says it's critically important that regulated companies strictly adheres to the state rules and regulations. If a regulated entity like Charter Cable Business decides to violate or ignore the rules, the PSC will take swift action and hold it accountable to the full extent of the law. The allegations relate both to Charter's 2011 franchise agreements with New York City and statewide commitments Charter made in order to get state approval of its 2016 acquisition of Time Warner Cable. Charter told the commission that it met the latest merger build-out deadline, but a detailed audit by commission staff found that more than 14,000 passings claimed by Charter for its December milestone were ineligible, causing Charter to fall short of the milestone by more than 8,000 passings. Charter claimed it met the Time Warner Cable merger build-out commitments in part by expanding service in New York City. But Charter's new broadband deployments in New York City included addresses that the company was already required to serve as part of the franchise agreements. If Charter wasn't already serving those addresses in New York City, it would have violated the franchise agreements. But if Charter was already serving those addresses, then they can't count towards the new construction required in order to meet merger commitments. A major problem that I have come across talking to people who have Charter Spectrum is speed. It's very slow, and right now, they're not meeting the requirements. It is, however, that it seems unlikely that the New York Public Service Commission would revoke Charter's New York City franchises, as it is threatening to do, but starting the process could pressure Charter to satisfy the state demands for more broadband deployment. The New York Public Service Commission used online mapping tools as part of its investigation and visited 490 addresses in New York City, gaining access to 462 of them. All of these 462 were either served by pre-existing Charter network, 100 megabit service from another provider, or a combination of both. The commission provided a few specific examples. Two multi-unit buildings with a combined 214 residential units should already have been served by Charter under its franchise agreement. The commission also described what it called a more egregious example. Charter also lists the Reuters building as countable towards the December 2017 target in Charter's January 2018 filing, which has a listed address of 3 Times Square, but the staff could not find any photos of the building prior to the 2014, but construction was completed in 2001, well before the effective date of the current franchise agreement. If Charter's network was not capable of providing these addresses with the service, then it appears it may be a material breach in the New York City franchise renewal that warrants further investigation and grounds to begin revocation proceedings. There are many examples that the New York City Commission cited where there were claims that there were installations made, but in actually visiting the physical sites, they were not. The state also says that the Charter plan to serve 145,000 addresses by 2020 includes 11,979 addresses that should not count towards the target. Many of these addresses are in census blocks, where the state has separate plans to award broadband deployment grants to ISPs. The PSC gave Charter 21 days to provide a full response. For the last 10 years, the cell phone industry was ruled by Verizon and AT&T. They were the biggest networks with the most subscribers and the best coverage, and it wasn't even close for the others. But in the last few years, T-Mobile has spent aggressively to try to bridge the gap between its network and the competitors. According to the latest OpenSignal regional study, the transformation is complete. Verizon and T-Mobile are in a virtual tie for first place, based on availability and speed, while AT&T and Sprint are, well, duking it out to not be in last place. OpenSignal collects data from hundreds of thousands of smartphone users, all of whom have OpenSignal app downloaded on their device. The app runs periodic speed tests in the background, and the data is sent back to OpenSignal. They aggregate the results and produce the nationwide and regional studies. Data like this is contentious, to say the least, because it's less scientific than road testing, which tests all four networks side by side in thousands of locations. But you can argue that road testing is only an approximation anyway of what real-world usage is, whereas testing has so much data available that it's more representative look at network quality where people are really using their devices. No party will actually agree which source is better, and of course, RootMetrics road testing shows Verizon as number one network and T-Mobile in third or fourth place that Verizon likes to quote. OpenSignal is normally most flattering to T-Mobile, so you can guess which data set T-Mobile is quoting. Either way, the most foolproof method to interpret the data is by looking at the changes over time. Rather than just who comes in first place on any one particular study, you can see that something has changed to make T-Mobile network better relative to the competition over the last 5 years. The picture was very different a year ago when Verizon was the clear winner in LTE availability across all five regions. As for the results from this year, it's clear that T-Mobile and Verizon are in a statistical tie for first place in availability. The picture is a little more favorable to T-Mobile on speeds, where average LTE download speed was better than Verizon everywhere but the West. A robocall is a phone call that uses a computerized autodialer to deliver a pre-recorded message, as if from a robot. Robocalls are often associated with political or telemarketing phone campaigns, but can also be used for public service or emergency announcements. The FCC permits non-commercial robocalls to most residential, non-cellular telephone lines. The Federal Telephone Consumer Protection Act of 1991 regulates automated calls. Some states, 23 of them, have laws that regulate or prohibit political robocalls. A federal appeals court on Friday overturned a portion of a Federal Communications Commission regulation aimed at curbing unwanted calls from nuisance telemarketing companies. I get a lot of them, and I don't know how to stop them. The court found that a provision of the Telephone Consumer Protection Act intended to limit the use of automated dialers to make uninvited calls was unreasonably expansive. The rule amending the TCPA was passed by the Federal Communications Commission in 2015. The agency's 2015 rule limited unwanted telephone solicitations. The rule was aimed at calls generated by auto dialing services, but its language was too broad and could be construed to prohibit calls from any smartphone. The U.S. Courts of Appeal for the District of Columbia ruled in a unanimous opinion Friday. The case heard by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia was brought against the FCC by ACA International. It's a trade association representing credit and collection agencies. Specifically, the court found that a provision intended to limit robocalls was too broadly defined. The FCC had expanded the definition of what constituted an automatic telephone dialing system, otherwise known as ATDS, to the point that it may have been construed as applying to basically anyone with a smartphone. Under the statute on ATDS, an autodialer was defined to mean any equipment that could dial numbers stored or produced using a random or sequential number generator. Calls placed from such devices without achieving prior express consent from the call recipient were deemed to be essentially illegal. It is undisputed that essentially any smartphone, with the addition of software, can gain the statutorily enumerated features of an autodialer and thus function as an ATDS. Judge Severin Vansan dismissed concerns that smartphones might be swept under the auto-dialer statute because it is believed that typical use of smartphone would be unlikely to produce unwanted calls resulting in legal action. Well, the judge disagreed. He wrote, "If every smartphone qualifies as an ATDS, the statute's restrictions on auto-dialer calls assume an eye-popping sweep. Recall that the statute generally bars the use of an ATDS to make any call without prior express consent and tags each violation with a minimum $500 penalty in damages for each individual recipient of each prohibited call or message. The reach of the statute becomes especially pronounced upon recognizing that, under the Commission's approach, an uninvited call or message from a smartphone violates the statute even if auto-dialer features were not used to make the call or send the message. Imagine, for instance, that a person wishes to send an invitation for a social gathering to a person she recently met for the first time. If she lacks prior express consent to send the invitation, and if she obtains the acquaintance cell phone number from a mutual friend, she has committed a violation of the federal law by calling or sending a text message from her smartphone to extend the invitation. And if she sends a group message inviting 10 people to the gathering, again without securing prior express consent from any of the recipients, she not only would have infringed the TCPA 10 distinct times, but would also face a minimum damage recovery against her of $5,000. Maureen Mahoney, who is the policy analyst for Consumers Union, the advocacy division of Consumer Reports, said, "Consumers already are inundated by robocalls, will be hit with even more unwanted calls. Unwanted calls, including robocalls, are the top consumer complaint to the FCC, with more than 200,000 such comments received annually, according to the agency. And some private analysis estimate that the U.S. consumers receive about, you ready for this? 2.4 billion robocalls per month in 2016. The FCC's 2015 rule would have extended a law originally intended to deal with hundreds of thousands of telemarketers into one constraining hundreds of millions of everyday callers. The three-judge panel wrote in a unanimous opinion, "Under the FCC rule, any uninvited call or message from the device is a statutory violation. Regular smartphone users could face a $500 penalty for calls, such as inviting a person to a party, without first getting consent to contact them," the judges said. As the court explained, the agency's 2015 rule places every American consumer with a smartphone at substantial risk of violating federal law. The judges affirmed part of the FCC rule that lets people revoke a consent to be called through any reasonable means. That was a significant victory because it puts consumers in control of when and how they can be contacted. Cash-strapped radio company iHeartMedia, which owns 850 stations and has a portfolio of digital offerings, has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. In a statement released Thursday, iHeartMedia said it will continue its day-to-day operations as usual, meaning you won't need to change the presets on your car radio or stop using any of the iHeart streaming services. The company is having a hard time turning the corner as competing digital listening options eat into its terrestrial radio revenue, and iHeartMedia's own foray into digital are likely to be a losing proposition. Chapter 11 restructuring is expected to reduce the company's debt. So what does this mean for iHeartMedia? iHeartMedia stated that subscribers and listeners to all iHeart stations will be completely unaffected and all their stations are operating business as usual, and listeners and fans won't notice any differences in the programming or on-air personalities and stations that they love. For iHeartRadio, the reality is that the terrestrial radio stations are in what is likely a losing war with digital competitors. Last year, the company touted that its services had 100 million registered users. The reality is that digital audio is a very tough model, even for the very best of services, and counting on continued user growth to counter an overall decline in revenue from terrestrial radio isn't a viable option, as iHeartMedia's current predicament illustrates. Indeed, though companies like Spotify and Pandora are eating into iHeartMedia's bottom line, they also are not doing so well themselves. Pandora, with its 5 million paid subscribers and 74 million active users, as of 2017, has been struggling financially. Spotify, which filed to go public earlier this month, posted a loss in 2017 and has never turned a profit. It's pretty clear that terrestrial radio is the past and digital versions of its future don't add up yet. No one seems to have a plan yet for what happens next. Stay tuned. Android Wear isn't dead yet. It gets rebranded as Wear OS by Google. Google just remembered that its smartwatch operating system, Android Wear, exists. While we're not getting new hardware software, the OS is being rebranded to Wear OS by Google. There's a new name, a new logo, and a new website to promote the brand. When Android Wear first launched, it was an Android-based smartwatch OS that only worked when paired with Android phones, so Android Wear made perfect sense. Google later added iPhone compatibility, which made the name Android Wear seem a bit misleading. It would be easy for an iPhone user to see the name and assume that their non-Android phone was not compatible with it. Wear OS is much more neutral, with Google calling it Wearables Operating System for Everyone. The situation is a lot like Google's other recent name change when it switched Android Pay to Google Pay. From the OS side of things, major updates don't come fast. Android Wear 2.0 was released about 13 months ago, and we haven't heard a peep about a new version. Before that, we went 2.5 years between version 1 and 2. While the software stagnates, the same can be said about the hardware. Google isn't helping either, as it has never produced a Google-branded smartwatch, despite making phones, tablets, laptops, and set-top boxes. Of course, with all this stagnation, Android Wear hasn't been selling very well. Apple is the top of the market. Android Wear isn't even second, though that spot belongs to Samsung. The one thing Wear has going for it is Android's recruitment of fashion brands to make Android Wear watches. Consumers can pick from brands like Fossil, Guess, GC, Hugo Boss, Michael Kors, Tommy Hilfiger, and others. While they are mostly all the same hardware underneath, there are deficiencies with the design and poor battery life and stagnant software. They do at least come in a variety of styles. Could mind-reading apps, or, to put it less dramatically, apps that understand context to deliver what users want? Developments in context-aware personalized experiences are growing with a raft of technologies that utilize data and AI. Neura, N-E-U-R-A, is one such example. This claims to deliver AI as a service, which enables apps and devices to deliver experiences that adapt to who their users are and react to what they do. In effect, this is proper personalization or mind reading, based on what is actually going on in the real world. How did the idea for Neura come about? Several years ago, Neura co-founder and CEO Triinu Magyai was misdiagnosed as having diabetes type 1. Even though she was following the recommended protocol and checking her blood glucose regularly, her condition worsened to the point that she went into a coma for 2 days. Frustrated that medical tests couldn't figure out what was wrong, Triinu, who is a data scientist, started manually running algorithms based on what was happening in her life in the physical world. When she gave her results to her doctors, they determined she actually had diabetes 1.5, a rare form of diabetes that requires much different protocol. Triinu and the other founders realized there's a need to discover what is happening with individuals in the real world and bring these insights into products. It's because of Triinu's experience that Neura has a mission of enabling products to interact with individuals throughout their day. Amazon has added a new feature to its Alexa voice assistant that will let you make successive requests without needing to repeat your Echo speaker's wake word. Amazon is calling the new setting follow-up mode, and while it won't let you nest one request into another, it will let you make multiple requests back-to-back. For instance, You won't be able to ask Alexa to turn off the lights and change the temperature in the same breath, but you can make one request and follow it up with the other without needing to say Alexa again. Follow-up mode works by letting Alexa continue listening for up to 5 seconds after an initial command. This is signified by the blue ring on the Echo speaker or other Echo devices staying lit up. Once the blue light fades, Alexa is officially back in the sleep mode and must be woken up with a phrase like, "Hey, Alexa," or whatever you set your custom wake word or phrase to. There are some interesting kinks here that Amazon may have to iron out. For instance, this follow-up mode only works when Alexa is confident the second command is not just background noise from a conversation or a program on TV. It's not clear exactly how that works, but it's probably safe to say that this feature may not work all the time at first, and it may register some false response. Follow-up mode is only available in English at the moment, and only works when Alexa isn't being used for another persistent activity like listening to music or an audiobook. It's no secret that Siri is way behind other voice assistants like Google Assistant and Amazon's Alexa when it comes to comprehension and total number of skills. How did Apple screw it up with Siri so badly when it was released so far in advance of the competition? A new report reveals how years of missteps left Siri eating dust. According to the report, after acquiring the original Siri app in 2010 for $200 million, Apple proceeded to quickly integrate the digital assistant into the iPhone 4S in 2011. There was so much potential for Siri, and Apple promised to bring voice controls to the masses just as it did multi-touch on the original iPhone. Except the voice control computing revolution never quite happened that way for Apple or the way Apple predicted. iPhone users quickly realized that Siri couldn't do a lot of the things, and even after Apple opened Siri up with SiriKit in 2016, it still isn't as intelligent as Google's Assistant or Alexa. So what the heck happened? Instead of continuously updating Siri so it would get smarter faster, Apple reportedly only wanted to update the assistant annually to coincide with new iOS releases. Frustrated by all the patching they were doing to Siri, engineers reportedly batted around the idea of starting all over again. This, of course, is not how a digital assistant should be treated. As Google and Amazon have demonstrated, digital assistants need to be constantly updated in the background in order to keep up with the ever-changing demands of its users. The most revealing part of the report exposes how Apple didn't even have plans to integrate Siri into HomePod until after the Amazon Echo product was launched. Right now, if Apple wants to transform its assistant into a true competitor to Google Assistant and Alexa, it needs to sort out its internal management issues and decide what it really wants Siri to be. Linux Foundation backs new ACRN hypervisor for embedded and Internet of Things coding. Internet tossed in the code because data center hypervisors are too bloated for embedded use. The Linux Foundation has announced a new hypervisor for use in embedded and Internet of Things scenarios. Project ACRM, pronounced ACORN, will offer hypervisor and its device model complete with rich I/O mediators. There will also be a Linux-based service OS and the ability to run guest operating systems, another Linux instance on Android or other operating systems simultaneously. The Linux Foundation already hosts the XZen project, which has an effort underway to adapt hypervisor for embedded and automotive applications. Xen has made that effort a priority after Amazon Web Services signaled its hypervisor would not be a long-term choice that was revealed last year. But ACORN thinks Xen and other hypervisors built for data centers use can't do embedded well due to two problems. They're big, and they can't prioritize certain workloads. ACORN addresses the first issue by being small. The project claims it just has 25,000 lines of code compared to over 150,000 lines of code for data center hypervisors. The second issue is important because one target for Acorn is automotive use. Today, cars have several computers linked over a bus. It's widely envisioned that future cars will have one computer running a hypervisor to isolate workloads, an arrangement that will mean fewer integration hassles and lower costs for automakers. Acorn likes that idea, but thinks a hypervisor used in such scenarios needs to prioritize workloads related to safety. Conventional hypervisors can't do that, so Acorn will be able in future car computers know when to starve the entertainment system of resources in order to ensure drivers or riders' safety. Acorn may have another purpose, too. Intel's responsible for the Internet of Things of its code, and for now, it only runs on selected Intel PCs. The project's GitHub page says, "We welcome community contributions to help build Project Acorn support for a broad collection of architectures and platforms." But for now, it looks like Acorn hasn't fallen far from the x86 tree, which is good for Zen's effort as it runs on just about anything. Our feature segments tonight from Dr. Alfred Poor with Wearable and Health Technologies. He's covering soft contact lens kills cornea infections. Exoskeleton amplifies brain-body connections. And wearable sensor helps users cope with incontinence. From the Tech Corner, I will be talking about the Raspberry Pi and robotics. And on the home automation front, Marty Winston will cover audio notification in his cybernetic house.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
We depend on our eyes for so much, and if we lose our vision even in one eye, that can be a serious impairment that can cause all kinds of difficulties for us. It's kind of amazing that we don't have more problems with our eyes. We're constantly being bombarded with dust and germs and debris, and somehow our eyes do a good job of keeping themselves clean and functioning. The fact is, though, that it's not uncommon for eyes to become infected. According to the World Health Organization, corneal infections are the cause for 1 out of 4 vision losses throughout the world. 1 out of 4. It's more of a problem in underdeveloped regions, but it's a problem in general. And one of the difficulties is that once infected, it can be very difficult to treat these infections. Some are bacterial, fungi, and yeasts that can cause these infections. And there's even a type of amoeba that can cause a damaging and difficult to treat infection for the cornea. Researchers in Germany have come up with a solution. They've created a soft contact lens that's made out of a hydrogel. And then they treat this contact lens with what they call plasma-activated water. This is water that electricity has been run through, and it turns out to have microbial properties. It will actually kill germs, including the amoebas that can cause this corneal infection. They've tested these on discarded donor corneas that have been infected, and the contact lenses are highly effective at killing all the bacteria. They hope to start clinical trials for this new technology this summer, and if it pans out, it could lead to a low-cost and easy way to treat corneal infections and save the vision of millions of people. I've spoken about exoskeletons here in the past, and these are mechanical devices that you strap onto your body, typically the lower half of your body, and it can help people who have disabilities or impairments to help them walk again. In some cases, it's designed for people who are totally paralyzed. In other cases, it's designed to give an assist to those who are rehabbing from either an accident or a condition such as a stroke, where they need to have physical rehabilitation to learn how to walk again. One of the problems with these devices is that they often rely on motion or some sort of gesture to infer when the patient wants to start walking. Well, there's a new product that's just received FDA clearance for physical rehab. It's from a Japanese company called Cyberdyne, and they've created an exoskeleton that they call HAL, H-A-L, which stands for Hybrid Assistive Limb. Now, one of the things that makes this different from other approaches is it has sensors that are mounted on the surface of the skin on the legs of the subject. These sensors can actually detect the signals from the brain to the muscles when the brain is trying to control the muscles and make them walk, even if the muscles aren't strong enough to actually propel the subject. So what happens is the system detects these signals and then uses the motors in the exoskeleton to amplify those commands and to help the person move. In return, this creates a feedback loop because the brain can then sense that the limbs are moving and can determine whether or not they're getting the intended results from what they wanted. So this creates a feedback loop that makes it faster for the patient to relearn how to walk again. It's already available through one location in Florida. This could be an important advancement as we have these bionic exoskeletons that can assist people in all kinds of things, from rehab to even power assisting workers in the factories and such. Incontinence, the inability to control your bladder, is a common problem for infants, which is why they wear diapers. But unfortunately, it also becomes a problem for people who've had certain kinds of injuries, certain surgeries, such as prostate surgery for men, and also just as people age, the elderly can lose control of their bladder. For the adults, this leads to embarrassing and uncomfortable situations and a loss of independence, and it's not good for the self-image of the individual who's struggling with this. Well, a company called Triple W has created a new product that is a wearable sensor that sits outside your abdomen, and it uses ultrasound to monitor the condition of your bladder. And the interesting thing about this is it is able to detect when your bladder is full or filling, and it can actually alert either the patient or a caregiver to let them know that it's time to use the toilet. So this alert system can help individuals feel more in control, avoid embarrassing incidents, and for caregivers, they can help manage their patients better. People spend less time sitting in a wet diaper and that sort of a problem. This is an important development. We have many more people wanting to age in place as the years go on, and we have more caregivers who are trying to do more for more people with fewer time and resources. So anything that can help make them more efficient is going to be a good thing. So this kind of sensor can help compensate for an impairment that an older person might have and improve the quality of their life significantly.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. I have two granddaughters who are fraternal twins in high school. They are into robotics and are interested in a career in engineering. They have been working on robotic projects. I was just wondering if this was just a passing phase or there really is traction in this field of robotics among young people. Marty Winston has over 100 Raspberry Pis integrated into the building of his 40-year maintenance-free home, so I asked him. He contacted the Raspberry Pi Foundation, and the answer was quite surprising. Raspberry Pi Foundation was established in 2011. The foundation's goal was to offer two versions priced at $25 and $35. The Raspberry Pi is intended to stimulate the teaching of computer science in schools. They released their first product in February of 2012. Since that time, there have been so many different models of Raspberry Pi that, to be honest, I just haven't kept track of the number of models and how they differ. They have sold 19 million Raspberry Pi computers through 2017, which is a 5-year period of time in which there has been 6 different basic models. The high-end unit is the Raspberry Pi 3 Model B. 9 million of the 19 million sold were the Raspberry Pi 3 Model B, which was introduced in 2016. What was very impressive was that 5 million of that 9 million total were sold in 2017. The Raspberry Pi is alive and well, and it's not just a passing oddity in computing. There were a total of 262 million personal computers sold in 2017. So 5 million may sound infinitesimal, but in terms of development in the growing field of Internet of Things and the number of young people getting into technical design, that's a very encouraging number. For those who may only have heard of the name Raspberry Pi, but really don't know of its capability, well, the Raspberry Pi is a low-cost credit card-sized computer that plugs into a computer monitor or TV and uses a standard keyboard and mouse. It is a capable little device that enables people of all ages to explore computing and to learn how to program in languages like Scratch and Python. From the perspective of development, what can this low-cost card computer costing about $30 do? There is the Google's Android operating system, which seems like a great fit for the Raspberry Pi. It runs on ARM architecture, which is reduced instruction set hardware, and Android is based on Linux, and Google is keen to push for the next generation of coders. A fresh install of Windows 10 on the Raspberry Pi doesn't boot to the familiar Windows desktop. Instead, the Windows 10 Internet of Things core will show users a single full-screen universal Windows app. The system will only display the interface of a single app at a time, although the additional software can be run in the background. If you're a new user and your question is, which is the newest Raspberry Pi, you really have two options. The Raspberry Pi 3 Model B, which I spoke about, which is by far the fastest and most user-friendly and most forgiving Pi. The Raspberry Pi 3 Model B is the latest version of their flagship Model B series, and it features the most connectivity, including onboard Wi-Fi and Bluetooth. The Model B family comes equipped with 4 USB ports, so connecting your hardware like a mouse and keyboard is nice and easy. You'll never have speed issues or software issues, as the Raspberry Pi 3 Model B comes with 1.2 GHz quad-core processor. That's a quad processor, and 1 gig of RAM. And the Raspberry Pi 3 Model B is designed for beginners and those new to the world of Pi. The Raspberry Pi Zero Wireless, which is an ultra-low-cost unit, like for $5, is a cut-down variant of the Raspberry Pi B. If you have some experience on the Raspberry Pi, then the Zero W is the latest version in the Zero family. The Raspberry Pi Zero features an unpopulated header and only one micro USB input port for peripherals. Of course, you can put a hub to it so you can add more USB ports to the unit, but then it becomes unwieldy. The purpose is design as a card, and it's intended for embedded applications, wearables, and prototyping. The Raspberry Pi Zero is slower than the Raspberry Pi 3, featuring a 1 GHz single-core processor and only 512 megabytes of RAM. You know, when we talk about the Raspberry Pi 3 Model B, it's only for the $30, $35. That's no big deal at all. Marty compares the audio notifications in his cybernetic house to what we might expect from an animated doorbell in a Disney feature, and even demonstrates for us how a library of doorbell tones can keep occupants aware of what's happening without overly distracting them.
In our cybernetic house, if you push a doorbell button, we'll probably hear a doorbell sound even though there isn't actually a doorbell. I may be flattering myself with this, but I think of a doorbell the way that I imagine Walt Disney might have thought of a doorbell. Did you see Beauty and the Beast? In it, a candelabra did candelabra things, the clock did clock things, the teapot did teapot things, and so on. Imagine there had been a doorbell, a little bell that could fly from room to room, could ring or tinkle or make different sounds to alert to different things, could peek into a room to see if it's empty or if the occupants are asleep, and skip those rooms. In other words, it could act nimbly and politely and, yeah, intelligently. Well, why not? We can't create a literal or even holographic flying, shape-changing, many-tone bell, but we can get that effect to happen. If you heard our segment when we talked about our CAP, the Ceiling Awareness Pod, you may remember there are 30 places in our house where something in the middle of the ceiling has modestly amplified speakers within it. Little speakers, size of a stack of quarters. And we have the ability to pipe any sounds we want through those. You may also remember that we keep track of warm bodies, so we know which areas are occupied and which are vacant. In each of 6 bed positions, 2 per bed and 3 rooms, we'll know when you are sleeping and we'll know if you're awake, but fear not, we don't have any sensors that can tell us if you've been bad or good, so relax for goodness sake. We also know if it's after dark, if the lights are on, and what time it is. So when it comes to doorbell sounds, we won't be playing them to empty rooms, and we won't wake people up just because the newspaper is getting delivered. So what event should make a doorbell ring? That's a question that got me thinking about this whole matter. It started with the idea that we could make one kind of doorbell sound when they push the button at the front door and another kind when they're at the front door but don't push the button, like when packages get delivered. We can keep dozens of distinctive sounds in a library stored at each cap location in each Raspberry Pi. But some of the challenge is in choosing sounds that humans can relate to and, with luck, associate with events. For example, when somebody pulls into the driveway, this sound may be reminiscent of chimes you once heard at a gas station. And when that vehicle leaves again, a single ding not only relates to what you just heard, but also establishes itself as a little bit different. Even better, since a house is uphill of the street, we can take advantage of up and down to use this for incoming cars heading up to the house, and this for those heading down to the street. A different tonality can signal when cars are coming into the 3 spaces in the attached garage, with sequences that signal both whether the car is entering or leaving and identify the space. So our next 2 sequences are for exiting space number 2 and for entering space number 3. Most people who come to the house will head for the front door, and what we hear can tell us quite a bit about that. When a car pulls up to the front of the house in front of the front door, we hear this. When a person in the car or who walks up gets into the area near the front door, we hear this. And if they actually push the doorbell button, it's this. There's yet another kind of ring that happens at the mailbox. Meanwhile, inside the house, in a previous segment on the subject of identifying a room as being in the longer term vacant or occupied, I mentioned that it doesn't make any sense to isolate a room if its door stays open. But since the cybernetic design has the benefit of time awareness, it doesn't have to be dumb about it. Going into a room to vacuum it or grab something from the closet or anything else that takes less than 30 to 40 minutes doesn't change the status of that room. If it was vacant before, it's still vacant. On the other hand, leaving its door open for more than an hour will flag it as in use, and people are only human. So remembering to close the door when leaving a room while thinking about other chores isn't always at the top of anybody's mind. So remember, we have warm body tracking. We know when people leave a room, and if they happen to leave the door open accidentally, not deliberately, they might hear this from the cap or more than one cap nearest them. That's just a few of the tones in the library of doorbell sounds. As you think of that magic flying doorbell image, think about where you might use these. Remember, this is a house. It's not some TV show spaceship that has to be humming or go ping all the time. The house plays the tones where they'll inform, not interrupt, and they don't have to be played back very loudly. Imagine that if it were Hank's house, he'd have to add another familiar tone. The beep, beep, beep alert, that beep, beep, beep sound of a truck in reverse. As a reminder to everybody, to back up, back up, back up.
Thank you, Marty. P- Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the tri-state northeast area. Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on must-have utilities for your computer. Thursday, March the 22nd, 6:45 p.m. is the starting time of the meeting at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey. Princeton PCs Users Group will be meeting Tuesday, March the 27th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. The Danbury Area Computer Society will be meeting Tuesday, April 3rd. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group will have a presentation on different categories of artificial intelligence. Thursday, April 5th, meeting time 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road on the first floor in White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will be meeting on Friday, April the 6th with a presentation on home automation. Meeting time is 8 p.m. Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains. The New York Amateur Computer Club will have its general meeting on Thursday, April the 10th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Silver Building at NYU in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group will have their meeting on Friday, April the 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus, located at Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, and they meet in the auditorium of the Harry J. Scherer Hall. The meetings at the computer clubs are all free and open to the public, and we hope to see you there. And TCF 2018 is March the 17th, Saturday. It is a computer festival featuring talks, workshops, and vendors. The theme of the festival this year is wearable technologies. It will be held at the College of New Jersey from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. For more information, the website is tcf-nj.org. The keynote speaker is Dr. Nick Van Terheden. Dr. Nick is a leader in digital healthcare and innovation and former chief medical officer for Dell. The feature speaker is George Harris with a presentation on medical tricorders, taking science fiction into reality. I hope to be seeing you at the festival. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, on the Internet, and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM, 99.5 on the radio, or WBAI.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing, and remember, backup is essential, so back up, and don't forget, back up. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.